Good morning, everybody. I'm David Addington. I head up the European MedTech Research Team for JP. It's my pleasure to introduce David Endicott, CEO of Alcon. There will be a Q&A session afterwards. The company has asked me to remind you that they will not be making many specific comments around FY23, given they'll be wanting to talk about that at their full year results in February. But David, my pleasure. Over to you.
Thank you, and good morning. Let me start by giving a quick overview of Alcon, and just for those of you who may not be familiar with us, Alcon's a leader in a specialty market of ophthalmology. We, in eye care broadly, it is a really, I would say, kind of dynamic and important and very specific market, and I think, you know, we benefit a great deal from markets that are quite resilient. So when you look at healthcare and you look at priorities of government, when you look at people's investments in their own healthcare, eye care ranks way up on the top of the heap. Almost 80% of what you take in comes visually. How you process comes visually. Governments understand, I think, directionally that if you can improve the eyesight of many, particularly senior individuals, you can improve the productivity of that individual and also the collateral productivity of household members who may be caregivers. We benefit a lot from the resilient dynamics underneath all this, of course, because there's an aging Western population. There's an increasing wealth in many markets. The incident rate of myopia is epidemic. It's now estimated about 50% of the world will be myopic by 2050. There are a lot of new technologies, unless you think this is kind of a commodity market of certain kinds of products. It's not. There is a tremendous amount of basic research and application science going on around the advancements of visual correction or the pathologies that are most common in the eye. Those technologies obviously are delivering over long stretches of time and investments, but we feel really good about where the progress that we're making is and also where the progress of the industry is. So I think directionally, you know, we like to point out that, you know, this is a people business, and, you know, we look to find, you know, the technical knowledge that can drive specific application of science in this area. We're not necessarily experts at broad topics, but we are experts on the eye. We do know the markets. We know whether they'll develop or not, and that is the comparative advantage that we try and represent. It is specialty market knowledge around what is needed and what markets will develop over what periods of time, and it is specialty technical knowledge like material science, surface chemistries, fluidics, and energy delivery, things that are critical to the nuances of doing surgery in such a small space or correcting access vision on the in the specificity of the eye. Directionally, you know, we have a very specific hypothesis around our financial thesis, which is around disciplined capital management. We have been very much since the going out frame talking about how do we drive revenue growth and then get operating leverage. And so it has been a view that we can revitalize the company after spin by putting money into R&D, doing the very best we can to advance these important areas, and then particularly driving revenue growth through a more disciplined cost structure to try and drive bottom-line growth. And, of course, we feel very good about our progress. Just to give you some sense of productivity on that frame, you know, we have put, you know, as we've said, 7 to 9% of our revenue back into R&D. We are have made a lot of progress on projects over the last 4 years since spin. You can see a number of the noted here. Directionally, I think we feel good about both the productivity here, but also the long-term investments we're making for steady continued growth in a number of areas. So you'll see balance, I think, in the portfolio of incremental advancements around IOLs, but, you know, really significant advancements, for example, in equipment or significant advancements long-term in our contact lens business. So I think we see really interesting opportunities around the categories we participate in. We've put that money behind, directionally and importantly, behind very specific criteria. You know, where are the fastest growing markets and where are our biggest share opportunities? We've done a lot in the zones of specialty contact lenses. I'll talk more about that. We've gotten ourselves involved in the MIGS business, in the glaucoma frame. We've done a good bit of work around, you know, originally around PCIOLs. We used to be a very small share player. We are now quite a significant player in the share as a consequence of the investments we've made in R&D. And obviously, you know, we think a lot about, you know, how we continue to build our shares in markets that are continuing to grow quickly or where we're underrepresented in share. The productivity has been kind of represented here. We had a number of really great coming out products that we knew about, you know, with Panoptix. We were a little bit surprised by Vivity. Vivity's been a terrific advancement for the advanced technology lens frame. I think in the most recent of last year and then this year as well, we're now with our Clareon platform, which is a brand new material for all of our lenses. And as we work our way through that process of transitioning all our optical designs onto that material, we're getting a really positive response both in share and also ASP uplift. The long-term view, as we've said before, we're putting the right amount of resources, I think, behind new ideas like a next-gen diagnostic. We'll talk more about that at our Capital Markets Day in March. But, you know, there are really significant white space opportunities for us in the diagnostic space where we just don't play a lot. We've entered a product in Argos, which has been terrifically well-received. We're winning a lot of share in that space. We feel good about that. We have another follow-on product that we will bring to market the next couple of years around the diagnostic space that advances that progress. We have a next-gen phacovit. We have a next novel delivery system for our IOLs. And so I think you should expect steady progress over the next 5 years as we continue to bring incremental improvements, but also some real breakthrough ideas around how we do surgery in the surgical business. Same thing in vision care. I think maybe even a little bit more pronounced if you reflect on it. We started out with some kind of basic ideas. We've been able to put in enough capacity to produce new products on the same lines. And I think that's a misunderstood element of what our strategy is here. We have a very unique manufacturing capability that allows us to manufacture more than one kind of material, more than one kind of design, more than one kind of modality on the same line. So we don't risk, you know, stranding capital in manufacturing platforms. So we have been doing a lot of investing on manufacturing capacity because we feel like we can produce a whole bunch of different products, which we have actually done. So you see now, as in this last couple of years, we had a zero share in the toric dailies business. We'd never put one out. We got Precision One out. We've got Dailies Total One out now, both toric lenses. And now you'll see this year we'll produce the T30 toric as well, all on the same lines, by the way. So importantly, we're getting great productivity from the R&D folks, but also really good efficiency coming out of our manufacturing groups. A number of other ideas in here. Our eye drops business continues to evolve. We're looking to move the market to non-preserved multi-dose. That's a really big idea, I think, particularly for North America. It's very common in the rest of the world, but it is a new phenomenon to try and get the preservatives out of these drops. Sustain, in particular, has been a big move forward there. Pataday, we moved Rx to OTC. You can see a number of other products that recently we've acquired some eye drops in the pharmaceutical space, again, to continue to build on a capability that we've long had. As you go forward, we'll obviously continue to build out, you know, new and specialty-oriented lenses. And I think the message in the contact lens business tends to be, you know, multifocal. So if you think about, you know, we've really gotten ourselves into the toric business now in most of our modalities. What we really need to do now is next is look at the multifocal space, because multifocality is the easiest way to keep people in lenses. You drop out at 40 because you either got dry eyes or you're starting to use reading glasses. Keeping people in lenses is a multi-billion dollar idea. What we need, though, is better multifocal designs. The designs today, generally speaking, trade off near vision for far vision. You don't get the best of both. We can do better than that, and I think as you look at where we're going, you know, that will be one of the core ideas that we chase. Importantly, you know, if you think about our IOL business, you know, we start with sphere, we move to toric, we went to multifocal, we went to multifocal toric. That's the same cadence that we're working through right now with our vision care business. Think about it as sphere, finish out the sphere modalities, add the torics, finish, done, put in multifocals, then we're going to work on multifocal toric. Okay, that's well within our capability to do. It's all within the same kind of design optical engineering frame that we're excited about. So, you know, directionally, if I double click a little bit into the business, I would just say that, you know, the really unique part of Alcon's business in surgical is the breadth of our portfolio, and particularly the impact of our phaco machines and our vitrep machines. So our consoles that do the surgical work are without a doubt the market-leading consoles, and I think best in the world, best in class. To that, if you add things like now Argos, which we believe is best in class on a biometry basis, You know, you're getting now diagnostic through three-dimensional imaging at the microscope level. We've got a new analog scope called Revalia. We've got two world-class machines for cataract and retina. And obviously the consumables are where we make a great deal of the money, and that is built on all of the prior equipment. So, you know, that piece of work and then integrating all of those things with data, moving data from the Argos, you know, into the cloud planner, down into the OR, and then back to get capture post-op refraction, and then create a learning environment for the surgeon and the lens selection, improves outcome, creates better efficiencies. And that ecosystem that we have created uniquely, you know, will be, I think, the real powerful part of this next generation of wave of growth for us. Importantly, too, you know, it enables us to be in almost every OR in the world. So I think when you think about our footprint, our commercial footprint or our service footprint, one of the big ideas is, of course, you know, if your console goes down and you're out of business for the day, that's a real problem. If you're out of business for 2 days, it's a real problem. If you're in refractive surgery and you know, your wave light goes down, we're there the next day, or we're there, you know, almost, you know, the same day. So we have 3, 4, 5, 6 people in almost every OR around the world in ophthalmology. We have a big footprint. As a consequence, you know, we see the opportunities very clearly. We obviously done a lot with Clareon. I mentioned it earlier. I won't dwell on it other than to say this is the premier material in the market right now. And this material change, along with our edge design, has given us a nice lift on even our monofocal business. So, you know, anybody who, you know, we used to have some, you know, people would worry a little bit about small speckles you could find in some of the acrylic materials around there. It was always a cosmetic flaw. That's gone. But more importantly, the pristine clarity when you look through the scope into the eye for the surgeon is powerful. And I think that is playing very nicely for us going forward. We continue to do real well in the PCIOL business, but of course our monofocal business is also market leading. We've said and talk a lot about penetration. The penetration of the advanced technology lenses is a big deal because it's valuable. And I think, you know, this is kind of the multi-billion dollar idea over some stretch of time, is how do we move from monofocal into the multifocal products? They're obviously better for the patients, we believe. We think it's a great value. We think it's a great, you know, opportunity for patients to see brilliantly all over at every distance and every focal point. And today in the United States, it's about 19%. We, you know, as you look at that and you think about where it could go, we've done quite a lot of work on headroom in this space, what patients are willing to pay. We think that hovers in the 35 to 40% range. And obviously, you know, every point being $100 million, you know, you could do the math on this. That is directionally what we're trying to drive right now, is penetration of the monofocal market with advanced technology lenses. Obviously, you know, challenges in that we could talk about, but importantly, we're making good progress in the United States, but also internationally, where, again, I think the this last year we peaked out at, I think, about 12%. So still plenty of room there, plenty of room in the United States. If I switch to vision care real quick, I just would say, you know, I mentioned more about the Torix. You know, we have some really unique technologies here that when you look at what winning with torque looks like, it is about comfort and basically settling time or wearability. So when you blink, does the lens spin? You know, when it settles, how fast does it settle when it goes in the eye? These are design issues that you can work on that create clarity very quickly, you know, for the contact lens wearer. Our Precision Balance 8.4 design is a really important advancement for wearing design. And Precision One has done terrific. Total One, we knew would do quite well because of the underlying brand performance for Sphere has been strong. We've been surprised by both at how positive the response has been. We're launching the Total 30 Toric, I think, in the beginning of this year all over the world. So I think in as expected, I think we've been able to leverage the manufacturing to get ourselves in a position to make Torics on all different modalities and in all different materials. What that's looked like for us has been very positive on share. So I think, you know, when we look at, you know, our progress, what we're looking at generally is speaking is new end, switch fits, and total share. And so I would say that, you know, our view on the market has been very positive overall. So the dynamic for the value growth in this market is probably in that mid-single digit. If we can gain share faster than that, and we are, we should perform quite well. Looks like we have the products to do that. They're performing quite well. You can see the subgroups on the right, and again, the total market share for us, you know, over the last 2 years here on the left. With that said, you know, I think it shouldn't be lost on anybody that we are making some moves in ocular health. The eye drops business for us, we think, is a big opportunity. We have great manufacturing capability today. We still continue to make all the products we made for many, many years in our facilities. We make them for Novartis. We make them for other people. We have all of the capability and capacity to make our own. So as we kind of migrate from the OTC brands of Pataday and Systane into the pharmaceutical brands, some of the new ones that we've picked up, Simbrinza, obviously with the Aerie acquisition and the Cala product Isuvus, you know, we're making calculated moves into large markets. So, you know, we've purposely gone after dry eye, we've purposely gone after glaucoma because they are the two largest of the drop markets that are out there. And we have very low, you know, penetration of that in our own hands. So from our perspective, you know, this is a really opportune moment. I think if you reflect on where some of the major competitors have been, Allergan got bought by AbbVie, you know, Novartis buys Alcon. Both of them, I think, have taken what they wanted from those and left behind what they didn't. At this point in time, it gives us an opening, I think, to be very assertive in the space with technical expertise that is, you know, world class. And so I think where we are is right on the cusp of beginning a new white space to expand our eye drops business. And again, I'm excited about Rocklatan. If you think about the Rocklatan, put it with Simbrinza, you've got four mechanisms of action, maximum medical therapy in two bottles. So for those of you who are familiar with glaucoma, you know, these patients sometimes have three and four and five medications all in a bottle and not sure which one they use, which day and what time it is. It's not only a convenience, but it's economically valuable to put these combinations together. I think, you know, from both a efficacy perspective, a patient compliance perspective, and a reimbursement perspective, I think we feel like we've got a very cool proposition here for, you know, about half of that glaucoma market that is the moderate to severe. So very interesting opportunity for us there. Importantly as well, I think, is the dry eye space. And I do think that, you know, we bought the Isuvus piece because we thought the reimbursement could be improved meaningfully. And again, the reimbursement there has been a challenge for that brand. But it's a dry eye product that treats flare, and it's a really important concept because dry eye is an agitating chronic disease, but it has flares. And in this case, you know, a product like this can really benefit in that space. But it's also complementary to what we picked up with Aerie, which was the AR-512 product. So when you look at that product, that's a chronic use dry eye product that has a different mechanism of action, additive to almost every other product, and indeed complementary to Isuvus. So, you know, now you have two products in dry eye, you have two products potentially in dry eye, two products already in glaucoma, both of which I think, you know, give us a really profound opportunity to get back into and meaningfully impact some big markets. So exciting for the drops business, you know, and again, we continue to believe that there's a lot of opportunity out there. Let me give you just a little bit of color on our IFRS margin or our constant currency margin. I'll just say that, you know, we're getting good leverage, and I think the leverage story here has been something people are very curious about. I think we feel very good about the progress we've made. We have done better than I think we've articulated in the past. Whether you look at it in the reported number or more accurately, I think, in the constant currency frame for this year, 9 months of this year, we've got better than 200 basis points of growth in our operating leverage before currency. So the currency is obviously an impact, and as it returns, you know, it's returned a little bit in the fourth quarter. Hopefully we see some more movement towards a more normalized, you know, currency. But I do think, you know, we're already in that 20 frame that we've talked about in the past. We will continue to move that way next year. That is, you know, something we said on the last call. We feel very comfortable at our ability to get there, particularly, you know, having also made some cost moves, you know, to improve 100 basis points of cost for next year, you know, on the restructurings that we've done in the late last year. So I would say that, you know, our thesis that has been get revenue going by building R&D and building products and get back into this specialty space that has been vacated by a lot of people, and then drive revenue faster than you drive costs and be smart about your costs and your capital deployment. That's really what we've done, and that's what's delivering this leverage right here. Our capital allocation priorities reflect that understanding. So it reflects the notion that we are going to continue to invest in capacity and manufacturing in R&D organically. We will do some BD&L stuff. We've said kind of 50 to 500 is our comfort zone. We like technologies in that zone that we can add value to, either through commercialization or through access or through, you know, just pure leverage. But I do think that there are, we could do bigger things. We tend not to want to do them. But I will just tell you that the source of innovation for us is agnostic. I mean, it really is. We're going to do our own stuff, but we are going to keep looking for stuff out there that we think we can add value to. And then obviously we continue to pay out a dividend at 10% of core net income. You know, I think if you reflect on where we are in our journey, and I think that's, you know, fun to do a little bit because, you know, if you followed us since the spin, you know, we had a thesis coming out. I think we've delivered on a lot of it. You know, I think as you think about this first frame of 3 or 4 years, you know, we said we were going to put money back in R&D. We said we were going to put it back into manufacturing. We did those things. Those have driven new product flow. That's driven revenue growth. That's driven leverage. And we're getting exactly what we said we would. We're a little bit ahead of that plan even at this moment. I suspect we'll continue that way. We are a leader in some very resilient markets. So if you're looking for things that, you know, really don't go away, eye care is one of those ones that people don't scrimp on. You know, even in the recession times, people, you know, you can see it, you know, they stay in their lenses. They don't trade up. So there is some effect, but they stay in their lenses. And so, you know, we think these are good markets, high growth areas that we're investing in. You know, importantly, we've got a scale business in surgical that is a powerful asset to us. And I think, you know, as we look forward, we expand our ocular health presence. We've got some new opportunities to drive margins. So, you know, all in, you know, I think a really good start to this journey that we took on several years ago. So with that, let me pause there and we'll start with some questions.
Great. Thanks, David. Thanks, David. I'll kick off here maybe with a couple of openers and then we'll open up the floor. You addressed the FY23 margin, which has been a big sort of focus, certainly through the back half of last year. You addressed it reasonably directly on the Q3 call, but at least at a high level. And I know you want to give a lot more color on the full year results call coming up. But maybe you could just talk a bit more, maybe not just for 23, but beyond that, the pushes and pulls on the margin and what's going to drive us to that longer-term margin target.
Yeah. Tim, why don't you take the headwinds?
Sure. So as we said in Capital Markets Day last year or the year before, the whole thesis is really driven by growing revenue faster than the market, so we called out mid-single digits, managing our cost envelope in a responsible way. Now, we've done some restructuring to take costs out of the back room, if you will, and apply it to more customer-facing activities to drive that revenue growth, and that should provide nice operating leverage. So, you know, that is the key to the thesis. We've seen a lot of operating leverage this year. David alluded to it in the opening remarks. As you think about the longer-term plan, we will continue to see operating leverage on the SG&A front. We're going to continue to invest that 7 to 9% in R&D, so we shouldn't be getting a lot of leverage from that because, again, that's key to that revenue growth. And then in the back half of the plan, you know, we should see some gross margin expansion. So to date, we've had a lot of gross margin pressure. If you look at this year, we've had roughly 100 basis points of net inflationary pressure. As you go out in the back half of the plan, the other thing that's going to happen is those DSM flex lines that we've been installing that have created some near-term gross margin pressures, those start to work their way through the system. They run up at an optimal capacity, and we should see some gross margin expansion there. So, you know, the key to the long-term goals is really that operating leverage with a little bit of gross margin expansion.
Perfect. And maybe just kind of picking up on that gross margin point, what's your ability to put through larger-than-expected price increases or better price increases going forward? And similarly, the cost inflation that you've seen, how are you seeing that evolve from here?
Yeah, as we said before, you know, we at the end of 21, we announced some price increases that were effective in February 1st of 2022. They were roughly in the contact lens business, as an example, call it mid-single digits. We were the leaders in that. I think if we were to reflect back, we may have been a little bit more aggressive there. Obviously, it depends on what competitors are doing with the marketplace and how consumers are responding. But net-net, we had roughly net inflationary pressure, so price offsetting that inflation was about 100 basis points in 2022. And, you know, so that kind of gives you a flavor of we're not able to offset everything, but we were able to offset some of it.
Perfect. And then maybe you obviously acquired Aerie through the middle part of last year. Maybe you could just give us an update on what you're seeing sort of post-integration. And maybe more specifically, I just wondered, when you looked at the acquisition, how much were you attracted by the 512 asset in dry eye, and how should we be sizing that opportunity as we go forward? Because we're expecting some phase 3 data there later this year, I think. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the Aerie acquisition was, we had thought about for a long time, and it was built largely on the market performance of Rocklatan. So, you know, I think our view is that the deal sits on itself, between consolidation value and the Rocklatan performance. You know, that in and of itself we think made sense. The 512 was upside to the business case, and so I think, you know, to the extent that it's approved, we get excited about that. We also believed that we wanted a capability that they had, and they've got a very good group in pharma development in North Carolina that we were pleased to acquire as well, which gives us, you know, a little bit more of what we lost, you know, in the spin to Novartis. So, you know, we felt like it gave us a couple of things, a capability, importantly, that we needed. We had a lot of synergy on the commercial and infrastructure stuff, so that helped us a good bit. And then, of course, you know, we think there's growth in Rocklatan when you put it together with our commercialization effort and mechanism. The other part of your question was?
Just into sort of sizing the opportunity and
we're still working through that because, you know, it's still pretty fresh for us. But I do think that the way to think about that market, it's a billion seven in the U.S. It's going to shrink because Restasis is going to go generic. But dry eye is the largest, you know, it's like the second largest incident visit that happens in ophthalmology. It's a very, very big category. A lot of it's going to depend on genuinely how the product performs. We'll see that data, I think, in the late this year. You know, we'll have an opportunity to kind of release that next year and give you a sense probably as we go through the year this year on how we're thinking about the market. But we're still learning a little bit about it and want to be clear about it as we get there.
Great. Well, I'll open it there to the floor there. If there's any questions from the floor, please raise your hand and we'll get a mic to you. Over there would be great.
Thanks. Can you talk a little bit about the dry, beyond just what you're doing in dry eye? I mean, it's a pretty big market. Is that something you want to establish a deeper R&D division in or do more acquisitions? It seems like a really big market that Alcon should dominate over time if you put in the effort.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we like all the disorders in eye care, and I think about them as all kind of broadly, you know, things we're interested in. It's one of the bigger ones for sure. There are different approaches to it. You know, we've tried different things. You know, we've tried devices. That's been tricky. There are other mechanisms around this. The drops have been a big mainstay on this market. And I do think that, you know, our interest in drops here is meaningful. But again, I don't know that it's the only thing we'd be looking at. I think, you know, we're looking at kind of everything that makes sense, and in particular, you know, how competitive is the product and, you know, is it adding real value into the market? Can we extract, you know, a meaningful price, for promoting it? So, you know, I do think there are some things in kind of quasi dry eye called, you know, meibomian gland disorder, you know, which is kind of a subset of dry eye, if you will. I think there's several things in those spaces we're aware of. We watch a lot of it. We probably won't build our own capability. We're not intending to go after new molecular entities. You know, if you remember, you know, Alcon for years and years basically had a $4 billion pharma business made up of $200 million products. And we still think $200 million is sexy. You know, there's a lot of pharma that doesn't and doesn't want to do it, and that's in essence the opportunity size. So I think we'll find, you know, that there are lots of opportunities to repurpose things. You know, Timolol was a Merck product. You know, the prostaglandins were from Pfizer. The VEGFs were from Genentech and the like. So ophthalmology has repurposed those, and we'll get good at formulations, drug delivery. That's the capability we want, which is what Aerie brings us. And I think there's some other ways we'll do that. But largely, these will be already characterized molecules that we'll license from other people if we do the development ourselves. And then secondarily, we're always interested in licensing things that are further down the path, you know, preferentially phase two forward.
What's kind of the next generation coming in IOL so that it becomes more like a person having a natural lens? I mean, multifocal you brought out, but what comes after to really, you can probably drive even more people to it even sooner if it's more like a natural lens?
Yeah, I mean, look, accommodation is the holy grail, if you will. I mean, it's natural accommodation is the issue. And we will talk next month or 2 months, I guess, at Capital Markets Day in March about one of the programs that we have that's going after this. We have a very serious program that's down in Belmont. I was just there yesterday. And these guys are really world-class smart, and they've figured out how to make a lens move exactly like your current lens does. It's fluid-filled, but basically it flexes, and it doesn't have any of the characteristics of visual disorientation or dysphotopsias. It's a really important concept, and so if we can get accommodation and tunability in the same product, that's where the world goes next. In between here and there, because that's a long-run play, and we've invested some time and money and a lot of our own folks in that stuff. But in between here and there, there's going to be a number of advances that actually, you know, take things like multifocality forward and, you know, continue to improve on extended depth of focus as optical design. There's a series of ideas, I think, that we can kind of bridge our way to, you know, the promised land, if you will. But it's going to take time and money, and it's got a risk associated with it that we'll reflect on. But there are very, you know, I think there's nobody working harder on that topic than we are. And there's very little that we're not aware of that's going on in this space. So we're pretty tuned into it, so to speak. Yes, sir.
The one down the front.
So thank you. I wear those total lenses all the time. So, Tim, I think you've got to get some lenses.
Gotcha.
I've got two questions. Question A is, what's the price differential in the multifocal? And question two is, from a consumer, have you ever thought of putting color on these boxes or anything? Because every day I get confused between lens A and lens B, and everyone I know in my family does the same thing. And if you had color in the packaging, it would help. What's the difference in the pricing of the multifocal? What would it be?
Monofocal, in the United States, which is probably the easiest reference point, it runs, a monofocal lens will run about $100, plus or minus probably $20. Multifocal lenses, multifocal torics, are about $800, $900, plus or minus $100. So very different pricing, and obviously of high interest to us to shift to the higher value lens. Now, the government's paying for the first one. The government's paying the same amount for the second one. The patient has to pick up the difference, and that's obviously what is challenging about that. And on the color packaging, I'll take the note and pass it on. Thank you.
Okay, maybe it'd be good to get your thoughts on the potential for, if we do go into recessionary environments, for that mix in terms of AT-IOL, given the premium versus the monofocal, and what you'd expect to see there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've looked at the 0809 frame, and we've tried to figure out kind of what were the impacts then. You know, the AT-IOLs were not as well developed at that time, and so it's a tough proxy to really make any sense of, because it didn't have any impact in essence. I think, you know, we believe that the penetration on this is a complicated thing right now. There is, you know, in the U.S., for example, right now, it's kind of moving sideways, but it's always been 50 basis points a year for probably 10 years. And then all of a sudden with Panoptics and Vivity, it bumped up to maybe 200 basis points a year of improvement in penetration, and it jumped up. And now it seems to be moving sideways a little bit for at least the time being. So, you know, I think there's a combination of things going on in there. One is it has always kind of moved in fits and starts based on new products. And so as you bring in new docs and new patients, that seems to be, you know, kind of a method of growing that market. The second one is there is a clear staff turnover problem in this, and it does take time. You know, the typical consult for a patient coming through cataract surgery who is interested in this lens is probably 15 or 20 minutes. And that happens, it doesn't happen with the surgeon, it happens with a staff member. And that staff member is specially trained to talk about and show videos to and explain how the surgery works and what your options are and how it is that, what's the difference between a toric lens and a multifocal toric and why do I have to pay more and what does the government do? And if you think about seniors and working their way through that decision process, it takes them 20 minutes or so to get through that, ask the questions they want if they're well informed and the staff's good. And then they're expected to make a decision, which they don't always do. That process is hampered a lot when you turn people over. The training on that is meaningful. So we're spending a lot of our time going back now and trying to help the practices train staff on this, and then also make it simpler for seniors to access information on what is available and what is specifically available in the practice that they're in. Now, on the economics piece of this, my sense of it is, it's all gotten a little bit harder because there's just a general attitude that, you know, it's inflation, you know, I'm on a fixed income, I don't know if I want to spend the money or not. So the hurdle or the inertia of, you know, to get over is it takes longer. And a good friend of mine who's a surgeon, you know, was telling me the other day, he hasn't lost any, he's keeping roughly the same conversion rate as he's always had, monofocal though. But he said it takes me longer, and I have to do it myself, and I have to get involved in it, which means to me that his staff is not necessarily as good as they were and that the hurdle is higher. So I think there's going to be some impact from this. I think it's temporary. I also think that when you really get to the big picture, that you know, over some long stretch of time, this is going to grow, you know, into a larger number. We know the headroom is kind of in that 35-40 range, so I don't really think it's a matter of getting there. I think it's a matter of the pace at which we get there. And so, you know, again, I encourage everybody to think about that more than you know, what this quarter or this year is going to look like, because, you know, we've had these little, you know, sideways moves, you know, lots of times.
Perfect. And then your CapEx business has been really robust over the last 12, 18 months, probably for longer than people were originally expecting, probably longer than you guys were expecting. Mm-hmm. How long do you think that could continue for, you know, obviously being driven by the productivity issues that we've got?
Well, I think there's two or three things that are in that question to answer. One is we have been surprised by the availability of capital. So I think as we went through into the COVID time, we thought people's appetite for new capital would shrink. It was surprisingly strong. And so that's been one of the misses we've had. The second one, I think, was we did assume that there would be competitors coming that would have a bigger impact than have had. So I think some of that is access, some of that is availability. I think everybody's having a hard time making machines. But on the other hand, we've been able to supply kind of consistently. And then the third one is, you know, we have a fairly significant amount of installed base of equipment that is going end of life at the end of this year. So in the last couple of years, we've been kind of working through upgrading that group. We thought we'd lose more to competitors than we did. And so the good news is we're, I think, very effective right now at converting our own folks. So I think I feel pretty good about where we are. Now, going forward, yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, we'll comment more on it when we get to the February meeting. But I think, you know, equipment, I mean, I don't think that equipment stays at the kind of rabid pace it's been at. We've had a lot of good wraparound comparators as well. So probably settles down a little bit going forward.
Okay. Perfect. And then just aware of the time, the backlog, given the sort of the shortage we've had, particularly around healthcare workers, I think there's probably been a backlog of procedures. How do you think we're working through there, and do you think there's some more pent-up demand to work through?
Well, I mean, I think what we believe is that the likelihood is that this will be, we'll see, at least in the United States and most around the world, a slightly better than historical growth rate for many years. The challenge that exists in the United States is that most ASCs and individually owned surgery centers or hospital-based surgeries are running at, you know, mostly 90% of capacity anyway. On 4.5 million procedures, if you lose a million, you just can't make them up. It's going to take, even if you ran at 100%, you'd take you 3 years to get there. They can't run at 100%. Staffing's not there. You know, even if they ran at historical capacity, I think it takes a long time to clean that out. I think that's even worse internationally because there's less motivation to do it. And some of the international, there's a very large number of cataracts that disappeared, I'll call it, I think 15 million or so internationally. You know, what we believe is in India and China and some of the developing markets, they're lost. They're not going to come back. There's a fixed capacity. There's a fixed number of surgeons. The worst patients will get seen first, and, you know, they'll have to work their way through it. So I think that'll always be just kind of a capacity-constrained thing that looks a little bit hotter than it used to be, which was always kind of 3, 4%. So maybe it's another percentage point or two higher than that for many years, which is, I think, good in many ways is good because you don't get the bolus followed by a return. You know, hopefully we just get a nice warm, you know, headroom going forward.
Perfect. Great. Well, we're just about out of time, so I will wrap it up there. David, thanks very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.